Well, thank you for this very nice introduction, and good evening, everyone. It's always a pleasure to be here in Hong Kong. I assume that everyone in this room has a smartphone. Please raise your hand if you don't have one. And, you forgot yours at home. You have more than one. Okay. So it means at least one. So absolutely, many people have more than one, especially here in Hong Kong. So there's something like 17 million subscribers here in Hong Kong. And as you know, the population, as best as we understand, is around 7 million people. So more than two cell phone subscriptions per person here in Hong Kong. So these smartphones, and this is obviously what we're going to be talking about, are very exciting. Many of us have bought them because we wanted to download apps on them. And probably on average, people in this room have something about 40 apps on their smartphones, and I challenge you to tell me how many apps you actually have on your smartphone, and I'm pretty sure that none of you actually knows, and I'm pretty sure that many of you don't even know what apps are currently running on your smartphones, and those of you who might potentially know what apps are actually running right now on your smartphone probably have no idea about what these apps are actually doing. So what we're going to be talking about this evening is what are these apps actually doing, and in particular with the information that they're collecting about you, where does this information go, and what do people think when you tell them about what these phones are actually doing in the background, what these apps are actually collecting as you, you know, engage with games and other apps that you've downloaded on your phone. So this is what I propose to do this evening. We're going to start by talking for a couple of minutes about the mobile app economy, as people refer to it sometimes. And very quickly, we'll move on and talk about mobile app privacy. I'll try to keep this somewhat interactive, and I invite you all to potentially interrupt me and potentially provide also some of your own experience in this area. I'll try to do my very best to provide a balanced presentation looking both at what is going on iOS phones as well as Android phones and indirectly also on Windows phones. Those, as you know, are the three major operating systems these days. So we'll look at what information these apps in particular are collecting, for what purpose. Purpose is something that's often overlooked, as we're going to see. Why are the current solutions so ineffective in empowering people to actually understand what's going on and make decisions about what they're willing to share and perhaps what they're not willing to share? We'll look at, in particular, tensions between privacy and usability, and I'll share with you some results from our work at Carnegie Mellon showing that even though the situation is relatively dire at this stage, not everything is lost, and there are potentially some promising paths forward. Some of the research that I'll be talking about today is funded by the National Science Foundation in the United States, but also by companies like Google and Samsung that have funded some of our work. And so we're working very closely with industry and have been sharing our results also with them, hoping that at some point these results find their way into actual solutions. So in a nutshell, one reason why we're all here, presumably, is because we know, we've heard about this app economy, we're participating in it in some manner, and the numbers are very impressive. If you look at growth of this mobile app economy, it is about, I think it was about $26 billion last year, and one of the things that's particularly interesting about it, from our perspective here when we think about privacy, is in particular the portion of this economy that relates specifically to advertising, right? As you probably know, many apps are actually available for free, and the only way in which developers can make money with these apps is by supporting them through advertising. What people have said sometimes is that if you don't know what the product is, you are the product. Effectively, people are trying to sell you things, and even though you may feel that you're getting the app for free, someone is trying to make sure that somehow it's not as free as you think. And so one of the reasons why this app economy will continue to grow, and why many of us are so excited about the apps we're downloading on the phones, has to do with the competition that has taken place over the past few years between both Apple in particular through its iOS iTunes App Store and Google through its Android Google Play Store, as well as all the other non-Google operated Android stores. And this competition in part has involved trying to have as much content as possible so that people will say, I'd rather buy you know, an Android phone, or I'd rather buy an iOS phone, because there are just so many more apps I might be able to download on my phone. And so the question is, how do you manage to have more content than the other guy? And the answer has often involved effectively attracting more developers. How do you attract more developers? Well, you give them more APIs. And so there's been a competition about trying to effectively expose as many APIs as possible to developers. And that competition goes on today. So it started with your location. It went on with your calendar. The ability to place calls, SMS functionality, Facebook, you name it. A system like Android has something like 170 different types of APIs it exposes to developers, and then beyond that, you might actually be able to connect to a number of additional third parties through additional APIs that are being exposed. Those of you who've got Facebook have probably noticed that there are many apps that connect to Facebook. Those of you who've recently purchased perhaps an activity bracelet have noticed that companies like Fitbit have started to open their APIs as well to developers, and they're even starting to operate app stores of their own. And so that's really what we're talking about. And so there's potentially a lot of information that is going to flow through these APIs, and it's only natural to ask ourselves, well, where are the privacy policies? And so a recent study that was conducted by the Future for Privacy Forum has looked in particular at apps on the Google Play Store and the iTunes App Store, and the results are not terribly, terribly encouraging. So something like 28% of all the apps that they looked at were missing a policy altogether. Even among those that did have apps, many of them didn't have privacy policies that were available within the app. In other words, perhaps you can look at the privacy policy, but certainly not while using the app. And so it's very difficult to necessarily figure what's going on if you cannot necessarily access that privacy policy within the app. In truth, these privacy policies are a bit of a gimmick. I'm happy to do a quick show of hands to try to keep things interactive here. So how many of you have read a privacy policy over the past week? Okay, I'm very impressed. This is obviously because this is a presentation about privacy, and so we have people reading privacy policies. But nevertheless, that's only three people in this room, and I suspect that we've got more than 30 or 40 people in this room. And so that's an impressive number, but it's impressive and yet obviously very disappointing. So the vast majority of the people don't read privacy policies. When I ask this question in a more general sort of setting, I pretty much get no hands up. And I try to relax that question in a variety of different ways, such as how many of you have read a privacy policy over the past year, a fragment of a privacy policy, have ever read a privacy policy, and even as I relax these things, I still get very, very few hands. Right? So privacy policies, unfortunately, have not been terribly effective. And beyond that, as we can see here, often you don't even find them. It's not entirely a surprise. If you look at who is behind many of the apps that you might be downloading on your smartphone, you find that a very large number of these apps are actually developed by very tiny entities, something like one, two, or three guys in a garage. That's typically the expression. These guys are not terribly sophisticated. They don't have the means to necessarily hire attorneys. Many of them are doing this on the side. They're clearly not making much money. We'll look at potentially the revenues that people make with apps, and a very large number of people don't even make $100 per month developing apps, and so clearly they don't have the means to invest in very complex and accurate privacy policies. And so perhaps to make this so, how bad is this? Well, let me try to perhaps talk a bit more about what is mobile app privacy. And so I'd like to, again, keep this a little interactive if we can by asking you a few questions. So I know in Hong Kong, not everyone has a car, but let's do a quick show of hands here. How many of you have a car? Okay, all right. So about as many people as read... we've got more people who've got cars than people who read privacy policies. So this is good. So about a third of the audience, I think, has a car. So those of you who don't have a car, just pretend that you have a car and try to bear with me and see if you can answer these questions. So when you have a car, typically, I assume that's also the case here in Hong Kong, you're required to have some kind of an insurance policy. Is that true here in Hong Kong too? That's good. Right. And so when you go and apply for an insurance policy, there are a number of different providers, and obviously you want to get the best possible deal, and it's not unreasonable for the insurance company that's going to offer you a privacy policy to ask you a few questions. And so I would like to see with you whether or not you would feel comfortable sharing different kinds of information with a potential insurance company that you would like to purchase a car policy from. And so let's just start with some simple stuff, and we're going to just do this very quickly. So how many of you would feel comfortable sharing the number of miles or kilometers that you are planning to drive per year? Okay. And how many of you do not feel comfortable sharing that? One person. Okay. So diversity is important. That's actually something, one of the points I would like to make, but still relatively small diversity. Where you go and when? Right. So, and by the way, these are not unreasonable questions. In fact, insurance companies like to know that. Why do they want to know where you go and when and where you park at night? Because that clearly correlates with the risk associated with someone damage to your car and potential problems. So how many of you would feel comfortable sharing that, where you go and when? Please raise your hand. Nobody. Oh, my goodness. This is quick. This is not going to be very interesting. So nobody feels comfortable sharing, not even your address where you park your car at night. You don't feel comfortable sharing that. Okay. Most people, when I ask this question in the U.S., will still raise their hands, as it turns out. But I guess this is not going to be very exciting. But when I see all these hands raised, and I wasn't that lucky today, then I follow and I say, based on GPS information. So I can still ask the question, but given the answers I got just a minute ago, I don't expect to see many more hands. Anyone wants to change his mind based on GPS? No, I guess not. All right. So how about how fast you drive? How many of you would feel comfortable sharing how fast you drive? So a number of hands, very good. So many law-abiding citizens, and hopefully the camera is not recording all those people who are not raising their hands. So I think I got at least a third of the room raising their hands. This is very impressive. I don't get as many hands up in the U.S. when I ask that question. Now, please hang on and let me ask you the next question. Obviously, you probably saw that coming. So based on GPS information, how many of you would feel comfortable sharing that information? How fast you drive? Yes. So we still have some people willing to share that information. That's very good. And you might get a much better rate if you're willing to share that information, or a much worse rate. It depends on what they're observing. Let's continue. This is not unreasonable, right? As you probably know, many accidents, right, are correlated with people speeding. And in particular, over the past couple of decades, we've seen efforts worldwide to decrease speed limits. And there are lots of statistics that are showing that as you decrease speed limits, you actually see a reduction in number of accidents. So it's not unreasonable, I would say, for an insurance company to say, perhaps based on GPS. So in case you don't know, we have a number of insurance companies that are offering policies in the United States that involve you accepting to install and report information with a GPS unit installed in your car. And you get better premiums if you obviously, you know, behave well, and your premium may not be quite as good if you don't. But there are many people who subscribe to this. This has been around for about 10 years at this stage, so this is not far-fetched again, even though many of you don't seem to be terribly comfortable with the idea. So how about your health history? How many of you would feel comfortable sharing your health history with an insurance company? Right. This is a yes. All right. Feel free to raise your hand. So this is not an unreasonable question to ask. In fact, typically an insurance company will ask you whether or not you're wearing glasses and things of that nature. Obviously, I didn't mention that, but typically when we talk about health history, we also include substance abuse, and we're not going to do a show of hands on that, although I'm sure we'd get very few hands. So substance abuse, as you know, that has a very major impact. Drunk driving, obviously, is the cause of many accidents. So again, it's not unreasonable. In fact, insurance companies in the U.S. will typically ask you that question also, right? And so I would like to quickly go on, but hopefully this is a little fun. So you're seeing that not everyone agrees. There are different perspectives, and it's not one size fits all, right? Different people have different views as to what they're willing to share, under which conditions, for what purpose. To finish, let me ask you another question. So how many hours you sleep at night? How many of you would feel comfortable sharing that with your insurance company? Okay, very good. So I'm seeing about a quarter of the room here raising their hands. I don't get as many hands up in the U.S. I guess my students don't sleep as much. Let's continue. And based on sensors, right? So how many of you would feel comfortable sharing that information based on sensors? So you're smiling, but what I'd like to say is that, in fact, your smartphone, everything that I've talked about, your smartphone can collect, not tomorrow, today, right, including the number of hours that you sleep at night, right? The GPS, you're carrying it in your pocket, right? In fact, traffic maps, right, that you get displayed by Google and Apple, this is actually collected based on information that's crowdsourced for people who are carrying cell phones.
Well, right. You must have a different smartphone, which is so smart. Mine can't tell whether I'm sleeping or not. Sometimes I even can't tell myself.
You can't tell yourself. Typically, when you're sleeping, you cannot tell yourself. But but you have actually a number of apps out there that will actually see how well you're sleeping, how many hours you've slept. And this is based on different sensors. The simpler ones include...
So you have to use those apps.
So your Fitbit, yeah, okay. Your Fitbit, for instance, yeah, but yeah. Also smartphone. Yeah. So you have, for instance, apps that will tell you how well you slept. You have apps that will modify the time when your alarm clock will go off based on how well you slept within a range, right? And so this includes not just accelerometer data. It includes also the microphone, listening to your breathing as you sleep. I'm not kidding you. This exists today, right? So go ahead.
A lot of them are not. I'm in this business, so a lot of them are not accurate.
A lot of them are not accurate.
The GPS is not accurate, especially in Hong Kong, if you're between high rises. Mm-hmm. And then these activity monitors, I'm wearing a bunch of them. They don't really know you're sleeping. They shouldn't know if you're moving. My son would not be sleeping at all.
Yes.
Because he moves all around.
He keeps on moving. That's right. So they're not perfect, but they're approximations. The GPS, by the way, is not the only way to find out about your location. There's very good Wi-Fi location tracking functionality. And so, by and large, even though it is more difficult to get a reading with GPS here in Hong Kong, together with Wi-Fi, and you can actually get pretty good readings. The point I'm trying to make, and these technologies will continue to improve. There's an announcement presumably coming out next week from Apple about its new health and fitness platform. As you know, Samsung just tried to beat Apple to it by announcing something earlier this week. And so there's a lot of activity in that space. So the point I want to make, yes, please go ahead.
If the devices are turned off at night, they can still collect information?
Well, it depends. If you completely turn off your device, then in principle, no. You might be surprised about some of the things that can be done, in fact, in terms of even waking up your phone. But, you know, in principle, if your phone has not been hacked, it should not be the case. But often people will, keep their phone on. Many people sleep with their phone just next to them. The first thing that they do when they wake up is actually, check the weather or email or other things on their phone. And the last thing they touch before going to bed is their phone, too. So just the accelerometer will often tell you at least how many hours they've spent in bed, perhaps not necessarily how many hours they've slept. The breathing and the microphone can actually do a fairly decent job at determining whether or not you're sleeping. And so when I talk about this stuff, and I actually lecture about this area on a regular basis with different groups of people. In particular, one of the courses I teach is for CIOs, and not too long ago, it was in February, I was lecturing to a group of people, and some of them were from the insurance industry, and they were really very excited when we discussed this. They thought, well, how come we haven't thought about this? We definitely have to do this. And they confirmed that, by the way, they're actually accessing this information, but not through your phone, right? But now they're thinking that perhaps they should start developing apps, like fun games that you're going to want to download. Insurance companies are actually thinking about lots of different apps. So what are the sorts of apps? And this is a tangent. I want to make sure I stay on time. But what sorts of apps would an insurance company want to offer you? Well, an example would be an app that stores your information. Right, like your driver's license, your insurance forms, your blood type, right? Those are examples of apps that would be very easy to convince people to download, and perhaps in the process they might decide to collect a bit more information, right? And they might even have a privacy policy that says, oh, and by the way, we're going to be collecting all that, right? Are you okay with it? And most people will say yes, right? So the point I'm trying to make here is twofold. Number one, this is not science fiction. Right, we can build apps that do all these things today. Number two, not everyone feels comfortable about these things. There are different views. Not everyone feels the same way, as it turns out, which is one of the big challenges in privacy. So, as we've discussed, there are lots of APIs out there for developers. And the developers have started to use them, sometimes fairly aggressively. In fact, many apps require information. We call these things permissions. For instance, if you use the Android terminology, each app has to declare what APIs it needs to access. And the user, in principle, for instance, in Android, the user will be shown these permissions being requested by the app at the time of download. The user has to make a decision. It's the worst possible time to ask a user to make a decision about these things, right? Psychologists have shown that our brains are wired to basically favor short-term benefits over longer-term, more uncertain outcomes. And so the only thing you think about when you download an app is to just have the app and be able to play with it. And you're clearly discounting all the privacy risks that might come along with that. But examples of apps that collect probably a bit more information than they need is, for instance, Pandora. How many of you know of Pandora? So this is basically a music app, right, a radio. It collects your location, I wonder why, your gender, year of birth, Path, how many of you have heard of Path? So Path is a social networking app sharing basically music pictures. And so it uploads your entire contact list. This is basically every single person and phone number and potentially email address without user full consent. Brightest Flashlight, I love this one. We've actually studied this one carefully. The FTC went after them following our study. They've settled now. So Brightest Flashlight, what does Brightest Flashlight do? Do you know? It turns on all the lights on your cell phone, in particular the flash. In order to do that, it requires access, full internet access, access to your location, and more. And the Bible, as it turns out, also needs your location. So these are examples of apps that are out there. We've actually studied these things quite extensively, and I'll share some of these results with you. One of the things that we did in the, this was about 3 years ago now, is after studying these things, we actually shared this information with people to see how they felt about these things. Many people were extremely surprised, including people who had downloaded these apps on their cell phones. Many of them actually decided to uninstall some of these apps. So here are examples of results for fairly common apps. So Facebook, for instance, collects your location. Not a big surprise. Actually, most people are not surprised. So 0% of people are surprised to hear that Facebook collects your location. They're expecting that. You've got check-in information. On the other hand, contacts list, 60% of the people are actually surprised about that. And 60% of people are surprised about the fact that Facebook also collects their unique device ID. Your unique device ID is something that enables a third party or Facebook to actually recognize you across many different sites, many different applications, right? This is effectively a super cookie that you can use to recognize the user and sort of track that user's behavior and sort of effectively, connect the dots across many apps, many services. Angry Bird, that's a fun one, right? So how many of you have not heard of Angry Bird, right? So Angry Bird requires your location, right? Many people don't know that. How many of you didn't know that Angry Bird required your location? Okay. Right, it does. About 80% of people are surprised when you tell them about that. It also collects your unique device ID. Pandora, 80% of people are surprised that it needs your contacts list. And Brightest Flashlight was the biggest offender in our study. So 95% of people were pretty shocked to hear that it required their location as well as their device ID. So that's the state of affairs. So the operating systems have actually recognized that this was an issue at some level. In particular, those of you who've got an iPhone might have noticed that there are actually a number of privacy settings available on smartphones, right? So these are examples of screens that you may or may not have seen. How many of you have an iPhone? Okay, all right. How many of you have seen these screens? Right, so most iPhone users have seen these screens, right? And so these days, you can basically decide to toggle your location on and off on an app-by-app basis. Same thing for apps that require access to your contacts list, your calendar, reminders, photos, Bluetooth sharing, microphone. There's actually more, like Facebook and the like. And then if you decide to go to location, you can actually look at every single app that requires your location. You can toggle it on or off, and there are additional services that you can play with. How many of you change these things on a daily basis? Right. All right. Well, so let me tell you about this one, just location. My group has actually studied location privacy preferences extensively. I've actually given a presentation on this a few years ago. Your location privacy preferences change based on where you are. It's not terribly surprising, right? You know, if you are in this room, it's probably not terribly private. You're probably quite happy to share that you're here. But, you know, typically when you are going to be at home or, in, you know, let's say that you go to a AA meeting, right, an Alcoholic Anonymous meeting, that's typically not a place where you're going to want to check in on Foursquare, right? So clearly different privacy preferences that pertain to where you are. And so ideally, if you wanted to actually remain consistent with these privacy preferences, you would have to toggle these things on and off based on where you're going. You would really have to do it multiple times a day. Nobody does that, right? And that's just location. And so you can just quickly see that these sorts of settings, while they're a good first step in the right direction, are absolutely unrealistic. Android, as you know, doesn't really have as much. For a while, it looked like it was moving down that path as well. And so when Android 4.3 came out, this was back in May, June of last year, they actually introduced, on an experimental basis, something called App Ops. And my group has actually looked at that quite extensively. We've done different studies with this, which is effectively similar to what iOS was offering. When they moved on to 4.4, they decided to turn that off. They realized that this was just not usable. They felt embarrassed, and they took it back. And so are all these settings good or bad? Well, in a way, they're a sign that at least these companies have started to realize that their reputation is tied to the behavior of these apps, right? It's not just about offering tons of content to users, but it's also about making sure that you don't end up being known as the creepy app store, where every app that you download will end up collecting way more information that you feel comfortable with. And so this is one reason why they decided to offer those types of settings. But if you do the math, right, and so on average, a user has about 40 apps on his smartphone. On average, an app requires about 3 permissions. That's about 120 different settings that you would have to configure. How many of you feel like configuring 120 settings and potentially changing some of these things multiple times a day? Nobody does,
well,
right?
You do. Is that we want to change it multiple times a day. In reality, I would like to have the ability to decide which apps I would trust the supplier, or in order to use the apps, I need to provide the necessary information. And perhaps once I change it, I do not change that anymore.
Right, so that would be right.
Than not having that ability.
And that will work for some apps, and that may not work for other apps. So when it comes to location, for instance, there may be apps that you trust and that you find valuable, but there may be situations where you want to turn things off, right? But that would be the ideal situation. We're going to be talking about those kinds of things. So this is going in the right direction.
Giving you the mechanics tools and you don't know how to fix a car, I would like a rating.
That's right. That's right.
People wouldn't know what's what.
Absolutely. So ratings, I think, are one promising path. The only problem with ratings is I'd like to remind you of the discussion we had a few minutes ago. You couldn't agree on what you felt comfortable with and what you didn't. Right. So how are you going to deal with a rating? She felt comfortable sharing, trying to remember, your speed and your health and number of other things, but you didn't, right? So something that might have a high rating for her may not necessarily have a high rating for you. And so if you are going to have ratings, actually you're going to have personalized ratings. And so we're going to go down that path actually in a few minutes. But we wanted to do is we wanted to see whether one could move beyond all these different settings, which are clearly unrealistic and manageable. And so we wanted to gain a deeper understanding of people's privacy preferences and see whether we could potentially simplify these decisions. And our work in that area, at least the work that I'll be talking about this evening, has involved doing this at two different levels. One is we have come to realize, and this is not entirely new, that privacy and willingness to share information is very closely tied with the purpose for which that information is going to be used. That's a fundamental principle of privacy, as it turns out. So the fact that you might be willing to share your location with one app for the purpose of that app potentially being able to operate is very different from being willing to share that very same information with that app for the purpose of this app, sharing it and making money, sharing it with third parties like analytics companies that build profiles about you, advertising networks that will try to target you better with ads and those kinds of things. The other thing that we wanted to do was to analyze people's privacy preferences, not necessarily just with regard to willingness to share this information in a generic fashion, but actually in terms of the purpose associated with that sharing. And so I'm going to share results with you about some of our findings, both in terms of how prevalent the collection and sharing of information is in this app economy, and how people feel about this, and looking also at differences among different people. So this study is a study where I'm going to report on the analysis of about 100,000 apps that we downloaded, free apps. This is what we could afford for the purpose of this study. 100,000 apps that were available on the Google Play Store. That's a meaningful percentage of all the apps. As you probably know, if you go to Android Google Play, there's about 1 million apps right there on Google Play. And if you go to the Apple iTunes Store, that's about 1.25 million apps. So 100,000 apps is a very decent number. It's a representative sample of all the apps that you've done. The technology that we've used is effectively, and Android is easier. It's easier to use Android to do a study like this. So what we've done is we've built effectively scripts where you decompile apps, you decompile the code of these apps, and you really look at what is going on. Right, and so this is what people refer to as static analysis in software engineering. Static analysis involves looking at the code. This code is obfuscated, but it's actually very easy to essentially uncover what's underneath. Decompiling Java, as you know, is not terribly difficult. And so for the purpose of this analysis, what we did is we looked at the code, and in particular, as we looked at the code, we looked for calls within that call to third-party libraries. And those third-party libraries are basically advertising networks, social networks, profiling companies, various types of utilities that you find in the code. And we looked at these calls to the libraries, and we looked at what information these calls were leveraging, such as your location, your calendar, and so on. And so that's the first analysis that I'm going to be sharing with you. And so to start, maybe let me give you a quick, at least, understanding for how prevalent the use of third-party libraries is. And so the quick answer is it is very prevalent. So among those 90,000 apps or so that we analyzed, admittedly many apps were not using any libraries, so about 40,000 or so, but many apps actually were using one or more libraries. The mean is about 1.59, the standard deviation is about 2.82, and the tail is actually very long, so I've not shown you everything yet. So there's actually, we found one app in particular that was using 31 different libraries. Out of these 31 libraries, 22 of them were actually for advertising purposes, some kind of a tattoo application. So we actually looked at, as we scanned all these apps and looked at the code, we built an inventory of all the different third-party libraries that you find out there, and we realized that it was actually fairly easy to organize them into a small number of categories. We effectively identified the following categories. We found targeted ads, right? That's a very typical type of third-party that you can find. Social networking sites, obviously customized UI components that effectively make it easier for developers to build apps. Game engines, that's very common also. Payments, right? So how to support payments. Mobile analytics companies, so those are the companies that build extensive profiles about you and resell this information to anyone who is willing to pay, very scary stuff. In the U.S., these companies, I don't know if you've heard of them, they're called Axiom and ChoicePoints and Experian. These companies have extensive profiles about every single person in the United States, literally hundreds of entries. And anyone with a few thousand dollars can effectively buy this stuff. This includes information such as your health information, right? It includes your financial information. It includes all sorts of very private details. Utility, content host, and secondary market. So the ones
so
that
it's
I'm.
It's not just the U.S. government.
No, it's not just the U.S. government. In fact, the U.S. government has been known to sometimes buy this information too. Because even though they may not necessarily be allowed to collect that information themselves, nothing prevents them under some conditions to potentially purchase that information, as it turns out.
Is it legal to sell personal information?
Is it legal to sell personal information? Yes. It is. So unfortunately, in the United States, fortunately or unfortunately, I would say more unfortunately than fortunately, we have, or our privacy framework in the United States is what I would compare to a Swiss cheese. So we have actually very good regulations in some sectors. For instance, in the financial sector, we have something called Gramm-Leach-Bliley. In the health industry sector, we have something called HIPAA and high tech. You might have heard of these things. We have something to protect children called COPPA. We have even a very good regulation when it comes to protecting the videos that you might be renting. Why do we have that particular one? Because at some point a politician embarrassed himself by renting videos that probably he should not have, or at least he didn't want his electors to find out about. And everybody got really upset in Congress about that and said, we absolutely have to make sure this doesn't happen again. So we have a very active system. And so nowadays you're very well protected if you still go and rent videos. I'm not sure that too many people do that. I don't think they've updated that for Netflix, for instance, which is a much more popular way of watching movies these days. So it's a Swiss cheese in contrast to what you have here in Hong Kong, which is much more comparable to what you have in the European Union, what you have in Canada, where you have basically sweeping privacy laws that cover everything that pertains, everything that's considered sensitive and that pertains to individual subjects, right? So extensions of PII and PHI and so on. So in the United States, that's not the case. But what I'm going to be talking about here actually applies to Hong Kong as well as Europe and Canada as well. So these issues of having privacy policies, that's it's still about consent, right? So if you look at your regulatory system here in Hong Kong, if a user opts in, right, then you can start collecting information. If a user is going to be opting in based on a privacy policy that he's never going to read, right, just because he's at the stage of downloading the app and he wants the app, you know, what have you accomplished? So I would argue that the privacy frameworks that we have in many places are not sufficient. They're not sufficient, or at least they're not practical enough. They may be sufficient, but they're not practical. And that's a big problem. We're going to be talking about that as well, hopefully, if we have time left. So let me share a bit of information with you. This is supposed to be an eye-opener. So this chart here, I'm going to help you understand it. This chart here shows you different types of permissions that these apps, these 100,000 apps or so that we analyzed, might be requesting. Not every app requires every one of these permissions, but what we did is for each one of these permissions, like for instance your location, we looked at the purpose for which that permission was being requested. And so we found that only 17% of the time, apps that require access to your location actually require the location for internal purpose. Like Angry Bird. Angry Bird doesn't require your location for internal purpose. Angry Bird, I can assure you, can work just fine without your location. So the reason why Angry Bird requires a location is because of this. So 73% of the time, when an app requires your location, it's actually for advertising purpose. 26% of the time, it's to actually build profiles about you. And 6% of the time, is to actually share with social networking sites. And so that is obviously, I believe, an eye-opener. I would think, right? So as you can tell here, and the same thing, phone state, this is essentially, who is calling you and access to your phone state. So ads, right, mobile analytics, much more than actually apps that really require this for their core functionality. And so that gives you a sense, yes, go ahead.
For the phone state, isn't that you just avoid interruption when the call kicks in, right?
This is the tricky thing here. So Android has actually bundled a bunch of different things under these permissions. And so phone state is more than it appears to be, right? And so it includes looking at the phone number that's calling you. It includes looking at the people that you're calling. It's actually covering a number of things. I don't even remember everything myself, but it's actually pretty sensitive, as it turns out. And so as you can tell here, there's a lot of sensitive information. Your location is clearly very sensitive. That's being accessed by these apps, and it's only being accessed to make money out of you, not for the app to actually operate. And so that's obviously very troublesome. It's particularly troublesome because most users don't even realize that, right? So when you look, and this is a bit more detailed than you probably care to see, but the point I want to get across here is we looked actually at different categories of apps. So among these 100,000 apps that we analyzed, we had pretty much all the different categories out there. There are certainly some apps where this is more prevalent, right? So a collection of information for advertising purposes. When you look at game, entertainment, those types of apps, that's much more prevalent than when you're looking at business apps. Business apps tend to involve less social networking, less analytics and less advertising. Not really a huge surprise. But if you look at these percentages, we're still talking about 10% here, and this goes up to about 45% for game and entertainment types of apps. So this is about as far as I'm going to be able to go as far as discussing what's going on underneath, but hopefully that gives you a sense for the magnitude of what's going on. So this is not like I cherry-picked a few apps that look bad. This is prevalent. This is effectively what a very large number of apps are doing today, right, with very little understanding by users about what's going on. And so the next thing we wanted to do was to see to what extent we could alleviate the user burden that would be entailed by these very complex settings that are being offered today by a platform like iOS, those very complex set of settings that we just saw a minute ago. And so in order for us to do that, we studied people's privacy preferences. We tried to understand to what extent people are actually feeling comfortable sharing this information for different purposes, like for advertising purposes with social networking sites and the like. And so this is a study where we basically looked at 725 smartphone users in the US. We collected information about 837 different mobile apps, and this was based on information about the purpose of the different permissions requested by these apps. And so we collected about 20,000 responses altogether about different app permission purpose pairs. Effectively, what I mean by that is we looked at the number of different apps, we looked at the permissions requested by these apps, we looked at the purpose for which these permissions were being requested, and we asked people to what extent they were feeling comfortable granting these permissions or not. Right? And so the population of people that we surveyed here was slightly skewed towards the younger generation, but this is not necessarily a huge, huge issue, because as you probably know, these are also the people who download most of the apps as well. They're not the only ones. And so very quickly, and without necessarily going to lots of details, let me start by telling you what things look at an aggregate level. So if you take the population as a whole and you look at willingness of people to grant these different permissions, this is roughly what you're getting. So let me explain a bit what you're seeing here. What you're seeing here, and I've just decided to list only a few of these permissions, you're looking at access to find location, course location, which is obviously less sensitive, phone state, contacts list, everybody in your contacts list, right? SMS, and accounts. These are payment accounts, these are social networking accounts, for instance, and the like. And so the colors here represent different levels of comfort. So something that's very light, like a 0.3, for instance, indicates comfort. Something that's very dark with a negative number indicates lack of comfort. The scale goes from +2 to -2. +2 means extremely comfortable, -2 means extremely uncomfortable, and a horizontal bar means we have no data on this because we didn't have any applications in the 100,000 applications that we had that was actually recollecting this type of information. And so as you can tell here, it's a mixed bag of things, right? So apparently, for instance, when it comes to find location, as a whole, our population of users was actually quite comfortable sharing their find location with apps that require that find location for internal purposes. Not Angry Bird, but Google Maps, right? Google Maps obviously needs your location. When it comes to advertising, as you can tell here, there is some level of discomfort when it comes to location, but not huge, -0.3. Right, course location, less discomfort, obviously, it's less sensitive, so these numbers actually make sense. Phone state also. Contacts list, people don't feel terribly comfortable, and this is across the entire population. Right, so those are the kinds of things that you see. What you're not seeing yet, and I'm going to show this in a minute, is how much diversity you have in these numbers. And so this is where it gets more interesting. As we just saw through the show of hands that we did earlier this evening, we don't all feel the same way. And so these numbers are somewhat deceiving. So when you look at standard deviations, right, and these are basically colors that indicate standard deviations, the darker versions of yellow indicate that there's a wide range of preferences, and the lighter version, right, nearly white here, indicate that by and large people pretty much all feel the same way about these things. So for instance, when it comes to contacts list, which seem to be creating a lot of discomfort among people, as you can see here, there's actually quite a bit of variance. So apparently not everyone is uncomfortable sharing their contacts list. When it comes to course location, also with advertisers, right, not everybody feels uncomfortable with that as well. So clearly some interesting differences here. So what we did is we actually proceeded to mine this information. And obviously this chart here is intended to show you that just as we did in our show of hands, a one-size-fits-all type of setting for all these things would not work, right? Because of these various shades of yellow that we're seeing here. You've got a question?
Just a quick question. Do you also look at the age range?
Yes, we have looked at age as well.
How do they compare?
We have a paper on this. I do not remember from the top of my head. Most of the demographic data didn't have a huge impact on this, but one element, and I think it might have been age, actually had an impact, if I remember correctly. I think that the younger population were somewhat more comfortable than the older population, if I remember correctly. This seems intuitive, but I don't want to completely state that this is actually what we measured. I would have to double check. Yes?
I also wonder about the controversy in the U.S. I've read about recently, referring to the danger of minors being exposed, I mean, the danger of minors who use cell phones, who have access to cell phones, and the parents may not understand what they're using the cell phones for. And can you imagine it's just a pedophile network's wet dream to be able to create an app that will collect, that will attract children to play games? And
absolutely.
All the locations, even the images and what
they're
browsing.
That's right.
And where they are playing right now.
Yes. Absolutely. And I don't know that this app has actually been developed, but there are very similar apps that have been developed to stoke on young women, and so very similar types of scenarios. Which, if adults already don't understand what's going on, what are the chances that children will, right? So, for children, as it turns out, right, when you talk about privacy with children, it's very interesting because they have this lopsided view of the world. So, for me, the most private place in the world is my home. For children, the least private place in their life is their home because they feel they're under surveillance of their parents. So they have very different and heavily distorted perceptions of things as well, both in terms of privacy as well as security. So one of the things that we did is we mined this data. So there are different types of techniques referred to as clustering techniques. And we tried to determine whether you could identify different groups of people and potentially identify settings that would work well for these different groups of people. And when you do this organically, you actually identify at a high level four different groups. You can actually do this at a finer level. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you this evening just how well you can do if you split your population just in four groups. And these four groups are actually very easy to understand. We have identified conservative people. We have identified what we refer to as unconcerned people. These will tend to be the younger generations. There are fence sitters that are actually representing a big chunk of the population here. And then you've got more advanced users that tend to be more sophisticated about the way they evaluate things. We're going to revisit this. You might say, well, do I really want... So one question that you could potentially ask me right now is, why do I even care what people want? Perhaps people are stupid, and perhaps, you know, I should tell them, like, you know, if you ask a child what settings he wants, do you really want to help that child have the settings that he wants, or should you just tell him, have these settings and let's be done? And I would argue that with a child, probably the parent should decide what the settings should be. But with adults, it's a bit more difficult, right? So there is this paternalistic view of the world where you can just, you know, tell people, I know better than you, and this is what's good for you. But that's not entirely compatible with our notion of freedom and democracy. And so one has to look for other ways of doing this. And we're going to actually be talking about that later this evening. I'll try to wrap up in the next 10 minutes. We start 5 minutes late, so hopefully I still have time. We try to make this interactive also. So let me show you what things look like when you start segregating people into these four different groups. So this is the group of unconcerned. And so as you would expect, based on the name of this group, you would expect to see lots of very light shades of pink and red. And this is obviously what we're seeing. Notice that most of these numbers are positive. So these people feel pretty comfortable sharing their location, not just with applications for internal purposes, but also for advertising purposes, also with profiling companies, even more so than with advertisers, and with social networking sites. So great levels of comfort. And when you look at variants, as you can tell here, there's a lot of similarity among all these users, very little variation. They all pretty much feel the same about these things. So it's very easy to come up with settings for these people, as it turns out, to the extent that you decide that these people are, you know, are smart enough, they're old enough, and they, you know, they should just deal with the consequences of their decisions. Now, the fence sitters are a bit more interesting. They tend to have somewhat more nuanced types of preferences. Notice, for instance, that when it comes to fine location, just as an example, they're pretty comfortable sharing that with applications for internal purposes. But when it comes to sharing this with advertisers, they have more reservations. This is a minus 0.33, as you can tell. Same thing for contacts list. Quite willing to share that with apps that require them for genuine purposes. Much more reserved when it comes to sharing this information for advertising purposes again. Now, the conservatives, as you would expect, tend to be much more red, right? And so, as you can tell here, find location with advertisers, that's a minus 1.33, but they're definitely still willing to share the location with apps when it's for internal purposes. And contacts list, extremely negative here, minus 1.91. So that's a no-no for this group, right? Probably many of us would fall in that category, but probably not all of us. So, and then we have this group of advanced users, which is very interesting. So again, find location tends to be always an interesting one to look at. These people understand the value of location-based services, but they're certainly very concerned about sharing that with advertisers or profiling companies. Notice that contacts list with advertisers is even more negative than the conservative group. They're basically at the bottom of the scale, minus two. Everyone agrees that this is not smart, right? And again, when you look at variance, right, it's a very, very, look at the zero here, right? They feel very much the same way. So I'm not suggesting that, you know, we can, you know, all fit in one of these four boxes, but if you just rely on these four groups, you can start predicting much better how people are going to feel about these things. And so we conducted some experiments where we asked people a few questions to decide in which group they would fall. And on that basis, we tried to predict what settings they would want to have, and we evaluated how well this would do. And this is just the first study. I'll show you actually more interesting results in a minute. And so we compared the one-size-fits-all predictions, which gives you about 55% accuracy. That means almost half of the time you're going to be wrong. But when you're using the predictions based on the profile that we've got here, you're getting roughly 80% across the board. And with conservatives or unconcerned, you're actually getting to about 85%. And this is a pretty large segment of your population, as it turns out. When it comes to user burden, which is the reason why all these settings are really impractical, this is effectively showing that if you were to rely on the sort of global average to make predictions, users would actually have to define 86% of these settings manually. They would only agree on about 14% of the settings. But you can actually reduce user burden for conservatives. You can effectively reduce the number of decisions they've got to make, the number of settings they've got to change, down to 11%, right? And even the unconcerned, you're getting to 33%. That's a very significant reduction. It's not the full solution, but we went a bit beyond that. So you might say, okay, you collected this data, right, but how do you know that this is really how people would want to behave? And so we're lucky enough to actually work with a company called LBE, which is a company based in China, and they gave us access to data about a few million of their users, all the settings that these users have, and they gave us access to this data showing effectively how in a version of Android, that's a jailbroken version of Android, people had decided to configure settings for 12 different permissions. These 12 permissions are sending SMS, phone call, phone state, call monitoring, contacts list, positioning, which is location, etc. And so this is basically an app that looks like this, right? It's also available in the US, and it's got basically a number of different apps, and for each one of these apps, you can decide whether or not you want to grant some permissions, deny some permissions, or ask to be prompted. Right, and after cleaning up this data set, which always needs to be done, we were still left with about 240,000 users, 12,000 applications, and about 14.5 million records. So pretty extensive data set here. And we looked at this very closely, and one of the things that we noticed is that on average in this data set, users had about 22 apps, a bit less than what you would expect, but still very meaningful, about three permissions per app. That's actually very typical. And what was very interesting is to look at the settings that people would pick. So each dot in this graph here represents a different app permission pair. So this is an app and a permission that it requests. And the dot is going to be located basically at a place that shows the mix of people who request to be prompted, the people who request to be who are willing to grant access, and the people who deny access to that particular permission. So, for instance, if your dot was here, it would mean that 100% of people wanted to be prompted about that particular permission. If the dot was here, it would mean that 100% of people are denying. As you can see, most people don't like to be prompted, and so they tend to align along this line. It's either allow or deny or a mix between the two. Most people are actually in between, right? So there's a mix of people who are willing to grant access and a mix of people who are not willing to grant, which is typical. So not everybody agrees, right? And so we proceeded to organize this and show that actually with machine learning applied to this, you can build profiles, but you can even go beyond that. And to make a long story short, these are the kinds of results that we came up with. So we played with the number of questions we would ask users and looked at how accurately we could predict their permission, their settings. And effectively, we showed that if you were to ask people about 20% the settings, if you were to prompt them for about 20% of the settings, you could actually reach an accuracy of about 94% in predicting how they feel about granting these different permissions. We feel that's a very promising result. We've actually shared this both with Samsung and Google. And the kinds of profiles that you get, this is just, again, a graphical representation of the kinds of profiles you get. I'm not going to go into lots of details, but you've got the 12 permissions here. As you can tell, they're very distinct groups. This is an example where we built three profiles instead of four. You can see there's a group of people that feels pretty comfortable sharing. There's a group of people that's a bit more sophisticated here, and it's a group of very conservative people. Right? So you can easily identify these groups, as it turns out. So with this being said, it's probably time to wrap up, and then I'll open up for a few questions if we have time. So one of the things I wanted to show you is, number one, there is a lot going on in terms of data collection through these apps. This is not just cherry-picking a few apps and, you know, showing things that are sort of pretty extreme. Those extreme scenarios are actually very prevalent. There's a lot of data being collected about us, and people have very little understanding of how much is being collected. Most people today just grant all these permissions, particularly in Android. You see the screen at the time you download your app, you grant access and you forget about it. You never go back. You don't really have the option of revisiting your decision. People are very surprised when you tell them what they've actually downloaded and what these apps are actually collecting about them. Many of them feel uncomfortable, as I've just shown you here. Unfortunately, if you look at the solutions that are currently being made available, be it in iOS or at some point in Android with this app ops system that I showed you, these frameworks are not practical. They're not usable. The number of decisions that have to be made by users are just way beyond what you can expect a user to realistically configure. And so I wanted to share with you some results that I feel show promise in terms of potentially simplifying these decisions. We're not there 100% yet, and clearly not everyone is going to fit in one of these four boxes, and we might need more than four boxes. But certainly the results we have at this stage suggest that one could significantly simplify these decisions. A couple of other things I wanted to share with you. So we've talked about the issue of whether or not you should actually allow people to just, you know, follow their instincts. And in fact, privacy preferences are very malleable. People have conducted experiments showing how just the way in which you're going to be phrasing a question will lead people to answer that question very differently. Right? So for instance, if you ask people, do you care about privacy? And we could do a show of hands here. Most people would say, oh, yes, absolutely, I care about privacy. Right? And then you could say, and by the way, would you want to give me all this information for, you know, a $2 coupon, you know, for a free sandwich at, you know, wherever? And then all of a sudden, people would actually give all their information. So that's an example of how you can manipulate these answers. And so if you want to do things right in privacy, it's not enough to just show these profiles. So my group and I, we've actually been working on what we call privacy nudging. And so we've conducted experiments now for a few years. We've done this on Facebook. We've done this also with mobile apps, showing that it's actually a good idea once in a while to pop up a message to prompt users, to remind them about what's going on and give them a chance to potentially change their mind. Right? And so we've done quite a few experiments in this area. We've played actually with different types of nudges, as we call them, different kinds of pop-ups. And you know, the kinds of things that you can play with would be something like, did you know that over the past 24 hours, your app shared your location 37 times with 5 different profiling companies, right? And then if the user says, oh my goodness, then you should have the ability to go back, see which apps we're talking about, and potentially turn off a few of these settings. But those are the kinds of things that I think offer also a lot of promise. So combine this, these profiles with something like this, and I think you would be able to make a lot of progress. Now you might say, well, okay, that sounds great. And by the way, I'd like to point out that we've just talked about the smartphones right now and the mobile app ecosystem, but think about the Internet of Things, right? Think about these bracelets that we're starting to wear. This is collecting a lot more information, right? So we clearly need much better solutions than what is available today. But beyond that, there's also the question of, you know, from a policy standpoint, can we do better? And it's very clear, as I've pointed out earlier this evening, that the current privacy policies are not working. Nobody reads them. Nobody understands them. I have also another project. It's actually what they refer to in the U.S. as a frontier project. So they select three of these projects each year. We're lucky enough to get one of them. It's a large multi-million dollar project where we're playing with natural language processing techniques and machine learning techniques to automatically extract answers from privacy policies, because people are not willing to read these policies. And even when they read them, they cannot answer the most basic questions. So we're trying to semi-automate that process. But no one reads policies. So, and even if people were reading policies, you can't expect these two guys in a garage to read policies. So we need much better tools, right? And ultimately, I would argue that the larger entities in this ecosystem have to take responsibility for making things better. And so the larger entities are going to be the app stores. Right? The app stores are in a position to impose rules, to review apps. There are lots of things. The technologies that I presented today, the static analysis that I presented today, could be the basis for tools that help app developers build privacy policies. There are some tools today for mobile app developers that will help you build privacy policies. This has come out just over the past year or so, through basically question and answers, right? So is your app collecting location? Why are you collecting location? You answer a few questions and you end up with a privacy policy that looks like it's been written by a lawyer. The only problem is that the guy in the garage typically doesn't know how to answer these questions. And I know this firsthand because even my students at Carnegie Mellon don't know how to answer these questions. So I ask them. So one of the classes I teach involves people building a mobile app to help navigate the public transportation system in Pittsburgh. And I had, I think this year I had 12 teams. They each build an app over a course of 3 weeks. So they're very efficient. And these apps work, they're all great, and I always expect to see a privacy policy from them, and I help them a little bit. But the first meeting that I typically have with them is like, does your app collect any sensitive data? And they all say no. Okay. How do you know which bus stop is nearest to your user? Oh, I use the location. Isn't that sensitive? Do you share that information with anyone? And then they say, no, I don't. But what are you showing me here on this map? Right, when they show the nearest bus stop. Oh, that's a Google map. So are you using the Google map API? Oh, yes. Doesn't that mean that you're sharing something with somebody? Oh, you might be right. Right. And so the point is that most developers are not capable of answering these questions. And so static analysis like the one I described could actually help automate that process and help people actually provide the right answers. So that's about as far as I wanted to go. Hopefully you enjoyed this lecture, and I would be happy to potentially take a few more questions.